Good afternoon. So today we're going to continue talking about exceptions a bit and some topics related to that. First, some mostly logistical stuff. So as you probably know, Rotate is due tomorrow. As I mentioned, it's the time on our testing machine, so you might want to, you know, find out what that is sometime before like 11 a.m. on Wednesday. To know whether or not you've, you know, did everything you need to do or not. And so, reminder, and Smooth is due after that, after Thanksgiving. Okay, and so let's go through some anonymous feedback. So apparently my notes and the book contradict each other, so I can definitely believe that this happens, but it's not intentional. And specifics really help, because if I get specifics, I will actually fix it for future semesters, and possibly this one. But I have some guesses as to things that look, at least look different from what we talked about in the exceptions versus the book. So one thing, which came up on the quiz, is what context are. So our book has this sentence where it says that contexts include the user stack and the kernel stack. This I just find really weird, because like when I think about like an operating system textbook, when they describe a context, it's the thing you need to change to switch between programs. And you don't want to be actually like copying the values on the stack over to another place, because that would be pretty slow. That's not what any operating system does. The pointers to those stacks, yes, those would be part of the context, not the stacks themselves. Not sure why the book says that. Another thing, which is more of a presentation difference, is how state is saved when exception handlers are run. So I kind of glossed over what happens as far as exactly what the hardware saves where when it starts an exception handler. I told you it needs to save the PC, or else we'll forget what the PC is, but I said that could be a special register or something like that. The book goes into a little more detail telling you about what x86 does. I avoided going into this detail because to do this, we need to talk about a stack for the kernel. And that often is confusing. So what the x86 processor does in an exception is that it saves the PC and the user stack pointer somewhere. Then it changes the stack pointer to a value that was specified when the exception table was set up. So somewhere when the operating system set up the exception table, it sets in stack pointer at once for exception handlers, which is a completely different stack allocated by the operating system just to run exception handlers. And the processor sets that stack pointer and then pushes things onto that stack. This is just a choice x86 made. x86 could have also like put them in special registers, which is simpler to implement in hardware, and some real simpler architectures do. The main reason I didn't go, follow exactly the book here is because all you need to know is that it's saved somewhere. And unless you're actually talking in more detail about how an operating system is implemented, talking about two stacks is just confusing. Okay. So a second, more specific piece of anonymous feedback, which might be what seems to disagree, is there was a question on the post quiz, which was, an exception is, and I mentioned, and the option everyone decided was right, was a process. So I agree, if I wrote that question again today, I would have said, like, is a special process, like the kind in described in section 8.2, or something like that. To make it clear that process is not like an English word, but like a jargon term. But I didn't. But I still think this question was sufficiently clear, because process was the title of the second section of the chapter 8 of the reading. Also, this anonymous feedback says the textbook never implies it as a function. I don't think that's really true, because the textbook says, has this, an exception is akin to a procedure call with some important differences, and then this list of differences. And that's what I was hoping people were reading. I think that's sufficiently clear that I don't feel like the question is wrong and I need to drop it. I mean, wrong in the sense of not matching the textbook, regardless of whether it's actually correct or not, from a correctness point of view. So that's review of anonymous feedback. So last time, we talked about exceptions. And the big thing we were getting out of exceptions was this idea of a process. That when you run a program on a machine with other programs also running, each program has the illusion that it has a dedicated machine. And we create this illusion with two things. We have a thread, which is the illusion of a dedicated CPU. And that we get from exceptions. That exceptions let the operating system take the CPU away from you and give it back. To you, it seems like you just have the same CPU all the time. It just, you know, has some funny timing. But in reality, you're sharing that CPU with other things, and you don't get to do everything on that CPU that you want to do, but it looks like you do to a first approximation. You also have this notion of an address space, which we'll talk more about on Thursday and over the next couple weeks, which is the illusion that you have your own memory. When you access a memory address in your process, unless the operating system wants you to, you're only accessing memory for your program. You're not accessing the operating system's memory. You're not accessing other programs' memory. It seems like you own all the memory, and all the memory you have is the only memory there is. And we also started talking about protection, this idea that we're not going to be able to do things that we're not supposed to do, that processes can't interfere with other processes. We couldn't overwrite the exception table and take over the machine and keep anyone else from using Lab Unix 1. That wouldn't work. That would trigger something that would prevent us from doing that. That we can't interfere with the operating system or other processes, except when the operating system has chosen to let us do so. So one way the operating system might choose to do that, talked about at the end of last time, which was system calls, that the operating system can expose an interface for us to do something we wouldn't normally be supposed to do. But other than that, the processor doesn't allow us to do it. And the big mechanism was this idea of kernel mode, that the processor has two modes. There's kernel mode, which parts of the OS running, where all operations are allowed. And there's user mode, where our programs run in, where some operations, privileged instructions, don't work normally. Instead, they trigger an exception, and the OS decides what to do. And in all the examples we've seen, the OS just gets rid of the program, it crashes it. We also have address spaces, which we need so you can, just overwrite the code in the exception handler. The reason you can't do that is that it's not part of your address space. The processor is going to apply this apping, which doesn't let you access it. And we had controlled access via exceptions. And we saw the big example of that with system calls. This deliberate trap to get controlled access to things that the operating system wanted us to do. And we saw this example here of a program that makes system calls. It looks kind of like a function call, but it has a different calling convention. In particular, we need to have a different way of specifying what function to run, because we can't just actually call something in the operating system and have it run in kernel mode. So there's this single entry point which needs to look at our registers or something like that to decide what functionality to actually run. And the system calls are the way that we can access all this functionality that we need the operating system's help for. We can't allocate memory ourselves because that involves changing the address space. So we need to ask the operating system to help us. We can't create new processes ourselves because that involves making a new address space and also returning from exception handlers in new ways. So we have to have the operating system to do that. We can't terminate a process ourselves, though we can do something where the operating system will get rid of us, which is why we have a system call for that. We can't access files ourselves because the instructions to talk to a disk are going to be privileged. So you can't access other people's files directly. And the way this, our constraints on what we can do are enforced is just because our system calls were the only way that we could access kernel mode. And this meant that the operating system decided everything we can do, not like explicitly, they didn't write it down in a list of these are the operations you can do and tell the processor. The operations we can do are whatever exception handlers you can cause to run do. So the operating system just needs to make sure that none of those exception handlers that you can make run, you can't do a seg fault or make a system call which like accesses someone else's files when you're not supposed to. That's how the operating system enforces its security properties it wants. And if someone messes up, if there's a bug in a system call where somehow we return data from someone else's file, you're out of luck. So any questions about system calls in general? And since this is mostly a review of stuff we probably covered last time. So one note about system calls is about protection in system calls. So when we talk about kernel mode and user mode, many people have the impression, oh, I've heard of kernel mode, that must be what root is, and it's not. Because you think of root or sudo, these are things where an operating system will let you do things you don't normally allow to do. But that's not because they're writing your program in kernel mode. This is technically a thing that could happen, but it's not the way any real operating system works. Your program still will need to make system calls to like read files, to allocate memory. The difference is that when you do something like sudo or root or superuser or various things operating systems call this, that the operating system will make more system calls useful to you. So all it changes is how the operating system responds to system calls. There's no hardware component here. This is just that when a system call happens, the system call handler looks up a bit in the operating system's memory, which says, hey, this user should be allowed to do more things. This program that's running right now. It doesn't actually run it in kernel mode, and you still need to make system calls to do everything, generally. So, I showed you what system calls look like as far as assembly and sort of an outline of what the system call handler looks like from a high level. If you actually use these system calls from C code, you're generally not going to end up writing code like this. There's not actually like a super easy way to do this in C, like there's not. It's not a type of function call. And when you're writing C code, even if you'd like to access a service like write or exit, you want it to look like C code. You want it to look like a function call. And on Linux, there are in fact functions which are often referred to as system calls, even though they aren't literally system calls because you don't call a function like that, because we have to use this special instruction. Instead, there are these things called system call wrappers. So these are functions in the library that exist on Linux and other operating systems whose purpose is to wrap a system call. Basically, this is converting from one calling convention to another. That's all this stuff, all this assembly is doing. So the difference we had between the Linux system call calling convention and our normal calling convention was that we had to have the system call number specified somewhere. So this code here, it sets the system call number because we don't set it through the address we jump to. Because we're not jumping, we're using triggering an exception. And that goes to the same place no matter what type of system call it is. There's also a little bit of a difference on Linux between what the kernel returns to after a system call and what these wrapper functions return. So the convention for the wrapper functions is that if there's an error, they set this global variable called ErrorNo, The convention for that the kernel uses is that if there's an error, it returns minus the error number to Rx. And so the other thing the system call wrapper is doing is correcting for that imbalance. That if it's that error, the error return, the way the kernel does it, turns into the way that the C function is documented to do. And so you might see C code on Linux, which uses functions like this, where the function is actually really simple, but its purpose is just to make a system call and get the arguments back. But we couldn't just do that directly because you can't call a system call with a call instruction. And so you might see code like this. So this is code that uses the open syscall on Linux, so that directly enters the kernel on Linux. FOpen doesn't do that. There's more library stuff going on. Here, this is directly using the operating system service to access a file, including the checking for the error and printing that out. And if you like read the documentation, you'll find functions like open. This is typically what they are. So this function is open, read, write, underscore exit, and the various other names I had on that slide with example system calls. Those all have functions in the standard library. That's what the functions are, because you can't just use a function call to call the system call directly. So that's what I have on system calls in particular. So I have one more topic about implementing exceptions. And for that, I'm going to talk about the trickiest kind of exceptions, which are interrupts. These are tricky because, unlike system calls, we know exactly the state everything's in when a system call happens, because we've set that up. We put in all the registers so they have the right value. We know exactly where we're going back to. Interrupts, we don't know where they're happening, and this is going to make things tricky. So one piece of trickiness is, let's say I have my timer interrupt handler. And just like before, the first thing I'm going to do in any exception handler is save the old state so I can, you know, switch to a context switch later on if I need to. And also so I have registers to work with. So I'm saving my state, and then there's a key press. Based on how we've described exception so far, what do you expect to happen there when I have that key press? What have we talked about key presses doing? Yeah?
The IO interrupt handler is going to be
playing. Yeah, so what we talked about is that when we have external events that the operating system might want to do something about, like a key press, we have an interrupt happening. So we would expect to run the interrupt handler for the keyboard interrupt while we're running the one for the timer interrupt. And the way I wrote this pseudo assembly code, I happened to overwrite the PC I just saved with the address, presumably, of this move queue instruction. And I've forgotten where I was in the program that was interrupted by the timer interrupt. Seems like a bit of a problem. So clearly, we better not actually do this. So what would be a solution to avoid this, either in the software or in hardware? Yeah. So one thing we could do is we could try to save all these values on the stack instead of into fixed location. So how much stack space do we need to do that? Like how much stack space should I allocate in mine for doing this? So the question is, how many exceptions can I have at one time? So it's not clear. That's why I don't expect you to know an answer. So like a one bad case I can think about, so if you want to save it on the stack, is what happens, if I press the key again really, 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 really fast, can I get another time keyboard interrupt right here? And if I do that, can I get another one immediately after that again? Can I keep doing that and then run out of stack space? If we're saving on the stack, maybe. It doesn't sound like we have done anything to prevent that. So saving on the stack is a good idea as long as we can make sure that we can allocate enough stack space, and that is a real thing that's done. But we're going to want a more flexible solution that doesn't involve planning for this worst case of how many exceptions can happen at once. which is what real hardware is doing, which it does seem a bit less flexible, which is that we're just gonna say that's not gonna happen. We're just gonna say that first, that interrupt handler is just not gonna, we're not gonna allow that. We're not gonna allow you to run two exception handlers at once, for the most part. And the way we're gonna do that is that we're gonna have support for temporarily disabling interrupts. So temporarily, we're not gonna do anything about interrupts. But we still need to remember that you pressed a key, we're just gonna deal with it later, when you're done handling this timer interrupt in this case. And the way we'll implement that is that instead of you thinking of we get a signal from the keyboard and immediately respond to it, we'll have some registers where we keep track of, do we have something pending from the keyboard? Do we have something pending from a timer? And also, do we have interrupts enabled? And we'll have some logic which will look at that and decide whether or not to trigger an exception handler again. And the idea is when we start running an exception handler, we'll start with interrupts disabled. And we won't enable them again until either the operating system runs some special instruction to re-enable them, or until we return from the exception handler. So this is a solution where we don't, where we can avoid worrying about allocating things in the stack and making that work, which is a viable thing to do that would be a real option. But this is typically what real modern processors do, also because there's other reasons we might want to disable interrupts in the operating system. So they have this functionality and they use it to make it easier to write correct exception handlers. Yes, you could probably write exception handlers if this functionality wasn't there and have them work correctly by pushing on the stack very carefully and all that. But this is what's the hardware is supporting to make it easier. And so what our timer interrupt will typically look like is that we'll save all our state, we'll do something to move that to a safe place, like allocate memory if we need to or something like that, and then we'll enable interrupts. And the way our hardware will work is after we enable interrupts, that pending key press will finally turn into an exception. And this is the typical pattern you'll see operating systems use for their exception handlers, is that they'll do a bunch of work to be ready for another exception and then enable interrupts again. So as I said, there's another reason why we'll have this disabling interrupts, and that's because although maybe we could deal with, you know, pushing things on the stack for exception handlers, there's another tricky thing we need to worry about, which is, you know, that the exception handlers have other state. Like, for example, if I have a key presses I'm dealing with, I have some data structures which tell me what process do I notify on a key press and things like that. And when I'm changing them, either I could be really, really careful about the order I change them in to make sure that if a key press happens at any point in that sequence, I will do the right thing. Or I can just disable interrupts, make all my changes, maybe there's like four different pointers that need to go to new places, then re-enable them, and I don't need to worry about having my interrupt handler see half of my change state and not the other half. Like, everything's gonna be together for it. And operating systems will commonly do this when they're manipulating data structures that exception handlers will use. So even though this is not part of an exception handler. Yeah, well, a normal exception. And so this interrupt disabling is another, you know, pretty useful hardware feature that's usually implemented for exception handlers. It's another part of the exception implementation. So I have a bit of a note on terminology. So I've been using a bunch of terms for exceptions, interrupts, traps, faults, and the book uses these terms, and it seems like, yeah, that's what those things are called. And unfortunately, the real world is not so simple. Everyone has different terms for every single kind of exceptions. So we're using the textbook's terms, but if you pick up any processor manual, it's probably different than any other processor manual. So for example, the Intel manuals use interrupt for every, as a general term for exceptions. You can find manuals which use the word exception, but they only mean faults, they don't mean interrupts. You can find manuals which use the word hard fault to mean aborts, and never use the word abort. You can find manuals which use the word trap to mean fault. So there's lots of inconsistency. So we're only going to use the textbook terms, but if you pick up a real manual, if you're reading something about how operating systems work or something like that, you should expect that, you know, unless you have explicit context, you do not know what the terms exceptions, interrupts, trap, fault means unless you are told. You should feel free to ask. That's terminology for exceptions. The word kernel mode also is a little inconsistent, but at least everyone who says kernel mode means what we are saying by kernel mode. But the issue is that there's other terms you might hear which mean the same thing as kernel mode. So you might sometimes hear kernel mode called supervisor mode, or privilege mode, or ring zero. These all mean kernel mode. Also, some systems have more than just kernel and user mode. They have something in between kernel and user mode, or some sort of like super kernel mode. So you might see that in some cases. This is where the ring zero as a term for kernel mode comes in. So in x86, there is a ring one and ring two, which are between user and kernel mode. They don't get used very much, but they exist, and you might hear them referred to when people are talking about kernel mode and things like that. So any questions on terminology? I'm going to have a bit of an interlude about virtual machines. So I told you that my view of a process is that it looks like you have your own dedicated machine. And we can call this a virtual machine. It looks like a complete computer. You have a processor and memory, and you have I/O devices. So does anyone think that's not what anyone really means by virtual machine? There's something else, there's something different that we usually mean when we mean virtual machine. People are nodding a bit. So anyone want to articulate, what's the difference between what we usually think of as a virtual machine and what a process is? Okay, so the interface is different. What's different about the interface for virtual machines?
With like VirtualBox, you see all the different icons and you've got the...
Okay, so we have more process management stuff, so UI. Anything else?
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's different levels of virtual machines, but for the most part, virtual machines, there's some kind of emulation of either software or hardware, whereas like in this regard, we're talking about virtual memory. Virtual memory is just basically like extending the memory that we have and creating this illusion.
Okay. Okay, so you're saying that virtual machines, you expect emulation of something.
Exactly.
And usually something like hardware. Yeah. So that's the biggest thing people are thinking of in virtual machines, is that, virtual machines have an interface that looks like a real machine. That's usually what people are referring to with a virtual machine. That it's emulating physical hardware. And our interface in our process virtual machine looks like something that would never be real hardware. System calls do not look like something you'd implement in hardware, probably. Virtual memory does not look like how memory would be implemented in hardware. But conceptually, it's the same sort of class of thing, and there are operating system people who like to call processes process virtual machines. There are also people who don't. But you can think of it as sort of a matter of spectrum, is how close is our interface to the hardware versus not. But an observation you can make from this is that what you need to make virtual machines, that like VirtualBox, is most of the same stuff you need to make normal processes work. Because it's almost the same thing, except the choice of interface is different. So we mentioned that privileged instructions, like say accessing an I/O device, like say writing something on the screen, presumably, you know, that if you're doing that directly, trigger a protection fault. Things that only the operating system is supposed to have access to trigger a protection fault. And so far, we've just said the operating system's going to crash. But the processor is running the operating system, and that's just code. That code could do something more useful. And the basic idea, if you want to implement something like VirtualBox, is that you write that fault handler, and you don't crash. You instead just pretend that that privilege instruction worked. You just act like that privilege instruction to put something on the screen actually did what it was supposed to do. And so this is kind of called trap and emulate, because you're turning this fault into a trap. You're turning it into something like a system call, and basically converting it into a system call on behalf of the program running in the virtual machine. So, for example, if we have our privileged instruction to send something directly to a monitor, we can figure out, okay, we have a protection fault, let's figure out what kind of protection fault it was, and somehow figure out that, oh, the program was trying to write something directly to the screen, and instead of writing something directly to the screen, we're not going to do that, but we're going to write to the program's output. Not quite the same thing, but it's close enough. And to the program, it looks like they're working directly on real hardware, which has a screen attached to it, but we're actually they're communicating with the screen to communicating like a normal process would. So there's some parts here which is not obvious how that's going to work. So one part is we somehow need to figure out what kind of protection fault this is, that the program had a protection fault not because it was trying to like set the exception table, but because it was trying to send something directly to this I/O device. So there are multiple options for how we could tell that. So the simplest thing for the operating system would be if the hardware just had like a special register which said, this is the type of protection fault it was. And we could just say, yep, it was trying to write to the monitor, we should handle it that way. And that's something some hardware will do. But we don't actually need the hardware to help us out here. We can just look at the instruction that was running and decode it. Let's see, what opcode does it have, what arguments does it have, and figure out what it was trying to do. You know, that's a lot of code to write, but it's not anything we need to change the hardware to do. And we can use that to figure out this was trying to write to the screen. And decide to actually make the system call version of that instead of, you know, crashing the program. And we also have a little bit of cleanup to do. So we're going to want to make, since we are pretending to execute this instruction, part of executing the instruction is advancing to the next instruction. So we're going to set the PC to move to the next instruction. So when we return from this protection fault handler, we'll go back to running the program at the next instruction. So this is how, you know, something like VirtualBox works, essentially. Is that they take all the faults that represent operations you're not supposed to do unless you're in kernel mode, and they turn them into emulations of the operation. They do something equivalent, but that actually works on a multi-user system. So this is the part of making the CPU of the VirtualBox work. We haven't talked about how memory works, and we won't, because that's much more complicated. The CPU, this is exactly what they're doing. It is a bit more complicated in practice, especially on x86, where historically there's some privileged instructions which don't trigger a fault for some reason. But on sane architectures, that doesn't happen, and you can effectively emulate the real hardware this way all the time. So That gives us how we make system virtual machines, and the mechanism is the same thing. So using these same mechanisms, we can emulate a real machine or the more convenient interface of the OS. It's just different choices as to what abstractions we expose. When we're emulating a real machine, we're making things that look like I/O devices. When we're making a real machine, we're making things that look like CPU cores versus for our process interface, we have these files and sockets which don't look like I/O devices because they're more convenient. And we have threads, which kind of look like CPUs, but you know, you can have as many as you like, which is not true of CPUs generally. So we're going to talk about one particular feature of processes on Linux and other Unix-like systems, and there's usually something similar elsewhere, called signals, which are sort of the process version of real machine exceptions. So they provide the same sort of functionality that exceptions have, letting you run code in response to important events that interrupts other code, but they're for processes, not for real machines. So these can be triggered, for example, by another process. When you kill a program that's running Berserk, that sends a signal to it, and that program can use that signal to not crash, but to instead like clean up before it exits. When you try to do something like press Control C, that sends a signal to the program, so a program that wants to handle that signal can clean up and do something to respond to the Control C rather than just being killed. And faults also do it, so if you access invalid memory, you can handle this in a program, not that many programs do, by setting up to handle this signal, like the operating system gets a protection. And signals, there's this API, which is a bunch of system calls. I'm showing you a very, very partial list of what those system calls are. So the key one is this SIG action one. So when we had our hardware exceptions interface, we just set up this exception table and pointed the hardware to it. Since we're dealing with software, we can have a more convenient interface that doesn't expose what the actual data structure used to have the list of signal handlers looks like. So we have this system call where we say, for this particular signal, I want this handler. Instead of setting up this big table, so it's simpler for us to do piecemeal. We also have system calls to send a particular signal, called kill. Any ideas why it would be called kill? Why would they choose that name? So it turns out the default action for many of these signals, if you don't have a handler, is to terminate the program. And because that's maybe the most common use of the kill system call, that's what it's named. You have things to wait for signals, to block signals, like disabling interrupts. There's the process equivalent of that, is blocking signals. Has the same sort of effect that it will delay the signal while it's blocked, just like disabling interrupts delays the interrupts, that key press notification while it's disabled. So let's look at an example of what this looks like. So here we have a program which sets up a signal handler for SIGINT. So SIGINT is the name of the signal that's sent when you press Control C. So that sends SIGINT to the current program. If you don't have a signal handler registered, the kernel crashes the program. If you do, it will run the signal handler. So here we've set up the signal handler that we pass to the SIG action system call, called handle SIGINT, which writes gut signal and exits. And this signal handler will run interrupting this code. So this code's reading in a loop. The kernel's going to invoke that signal handler in the middle of this code. So we'll see our gut signal message when we press Control C, even though something else is running. Very similar to how the hardware would invoke an exception handler, except in this case, it's not being invoked directly by the hardware, the kernel's doing this, the operating system. So there's some big differences with how this signal handler is written versus an exception handler, like the sort of outlines of exception handlers I showed. Anyone want to point out any one difference between something we're not doing here that I told you that we do with exception handlers? So there's a bunch of stuff we're not doing. Yeah?
We're still in user mode.
So we're still in user mode. So that you can't probably really tell from here, but yes. The signal handler is going to be invoked in user mode somehow, because we don't want you to be able to set the exception table by writing it in that part of the code instead of main. That would not be very good. You want to be able to disable interrupts by writing it in that part of the code instead of main. So anything else, anything that's different that you're not, that's not in this code that we would have expected in an exception handler? So if we remember our exception handler, what's the first thing we did? What's the first thing that this exception handler does? Yeah.
Is it blocking interrupts?
So it blocks interrupts, so we don't see an equivalent to that, but that's not done explicitly. There's something else. What's the first thing that the software does? The very first instruction in the handler. Yeah.
Save the
PC. Yeah. Saving state, you're saying? Saves the old PC and saves a whole bunch of other states. So it saves the state of the program. And we needed to make sure everything gets saved, because we don't know where we're interrupting. We can't rely on the calling convention, because all those caller saved registers, well, we could have been running code that was manipulating them. Because if we didn't stop in the middle of a call instruction, we stopped wherever. Wherever, in this case, Control-C was pressed. So you know that we don't have any code to do that, so that must be done for us. Somehow, all those registers and the old program counter are being saved for us somewhere we can't see, so that we can write our exception handler, sorry, our signal handler here, and it looks like a normal function, which exception handlers didn't quite. We also just return normally from this function. Well, in this case, we don't actually return, but exception handlers in general, they just use a normal return, even though when we have, signal handlers use a normal return, but exception handlers don't do that. We needed a special instruction to return. In particular, one of the concerns was we needed to make sure we didn't change the anything about the PC and any of the registers. We also need to restore all the registers, and that needs to happen somewhere. And the way Linux handles this is that Linux does a bunch of work in the operating system when it calls the signal handler, so you don't have to actually do what a normal exception handler would do and save all that state. So when you get the Control-C, the kernel gets this exception, and it figures out what the stack pointer is, and it pushes onto the user stack in its exception handler the PC that the user code had. It also saves all the registers onto the user stack, and then it adds a return address as if it were a function call onto the user stack, and then it jumps to the signal handler. This is not the only way of doing it, but this is what Linux has chosen to do when it runs a signal handler. So as part of the exception handler that the kernel runs before it context switches to run the signal handler, it saves a bunch of stuff on the user stack. It writes a bunch of stuff to it before it invokes the signal handler. And then it starts the signal handler with a return address on the stack so it can return to this special function called restoreRT. And that function is going to be what handles taking all those saved registers and that PC and actually using them to go back to where the program was interrupted without having any register values be wrong. So this is different than hardware exception handlers, where in the hardware, we expect that we have to, as a software writer, deal with most of this ourselves. Here, because this is a high-level API implemented in software, not in hardware, we can have the software do all this work for us of saving the register values and making it look like a normal return, even though it's not. So if we have our signal handler, it's going to execute a bunch of stuff. Then it's going to do a return. It's going to return to this address that the kernel pushed onto the stack, which goes to make a system call. And the system call there is going to read the stack, restore all the registers, and then return from the system call back where the program was originally interrupted. It also turns out that just like we had interrupts disabled, we have something called blocking signals, and the kernel will block you from getting another control C while you're handling the control C. And part of the purpose of the system call is to undo that blocking, just like returning from an exception handler undoes disabling interrupts. But this is done sort of for us because the OS sets up that stack to make that happen. So questions about how this signal delivery works, how the kernel is invoking a signal handler and making it look like a normal function call. Because we're doing this extra work that we don't do, that the hardware can't do for hardware exception handlers. So I told you sort of how signal handling works, and I alluded to what the signals are. So here are like very common signals. Note that each of these have a default action. If you don't register a signal handler, the kernel, gets the message that it needs to make the process do this signal, and it decides what to do. And the default action in many cases is to kill the process. So for example, we had our SIGINT, that was control C. If you don't register a handler for it, the kernel will just kill you. If you do, your code will run and you can decide what to do about control C. So one example is if you have a text editor, maybe your control C handler saves the file that's being worked on and exits. That might be handier than just going away. Yes?
So if you registered something for a segfault that told it to continue running, what is that?
So that's a question. So one of these is segfault. And segfault is what the kernel will do when it gets something like a protection fault or what we'll call a page fault, where you're accessing memory you're not supposed to. That will trigger a segfault signal. So the kernel will have its fault handler run, and what Linux's fault handler does is it sends the segfault signal to the program. If you didn't register a handler for that, that just kills your program. If you did, it tries to run your handler. And if your handler can continue doing useful stuff, your program will continue to run. If your handler invokes another protection fault, well, you're not going to make progress. Generally, I think the signal will be blocked and probably just kill your program. I'm not sure actually what happens if you block segfault and have a segfault. I think it kills your program on Linux. I'm not sure. But it doesn't do something particularly useful, pretty sure. Note that regardless of these signals, we're still running the signal handler in user mode. So the signal handler doesn't get to do anything extra. Like, it's not the case that just because you're handling a segfault that you can access memory you wouldn't be able to otherwise. Like, you're still restricted by the same things. This is just, where does the kernel jump to when it gets that fault? And also, of course, you're still restricted by like timer interrupts. Like if the kernel gets a timer interrupt, it's still going to switch away from your program even though you're handling a signal. Yeah, and as you can see here, there are things which correspond to faults, which the kernel reflects back to the process. So the kernel has an exception handler for protection faults when it uses that to turn them into segfault, which are signals. It has an exception handler for the illegal interrupt fault. And it uses that to turn it into a signal for programs which want to do something special in that case. So you can think of this kind of like how files provide you an interface to like hard drives. The signals are providing you a sort of limited interface into these exceptions in the same way. Linux uses signals for another purpose, which is for process control. So we saw signals as a way to send messages to processes and let them be able to act on them while they're doing something else. Run some code. But Linux and Unix in general uses signals also as the mechanism for making processes do things. So there are two signals which are special. So sigkill, if you register for a signal handler for it, it won't do anything. And sigstop the same way. They just always do the default action, which is terminating or pausing the process. They also can't be blocked. I mentioned, alluded to earlier that just like we have interrupt disabling, there's signal blocking. So that's the sort of the signal analogy to interrupt disabling. You can tell the kernel, please do not send me the signal. Please just have it be pending and send it when I unblock it. Just like disabling interrupts lets the interrupt, the key press, be pending until you re-enable them. Blocking a signal lets the signal be pending until you re-unblock it. There's this system call, think proc mask, that will do it. And this gives you an alternative to using signal handler. So let's say you want to respond to control C, but you don't want to do it in the middle of your other code. You just want to call a function and check, did the user press control C? You can do this with blocking signals. So you just block the signal, and then there's a system call to inspect, hey, what signals are waiting? This is not something like real hardware would typically have, and real hardware for exceptions. You'd have to re-enable exceptions and have your exception handler run. But because this isn't software API, it's more flexible. It's just easy to implement because it's all in software. So that means if I want to just wait for control C, I can block sigint, just tell you don't do anything about it until I unblock it and call sigwait, which says wait until the signal is pending but not delivered. And I can handle it without actually having a real signal handler. And the reason I'm telling you this is that signal handlers are surprisingly tricky and extremely hard to use safely. And if you need to write code that interfaces with signals, at least if I do, I would generally write it in something more like this. And this is because you can have really subtle issues with signal handling code. So for example, here's some code. Let's say that handle sigint is a handler for the control C signal. This code is incorrect. Astonishingly, this code is wrong and can do crash. So any guesses as to what might be going on that might make this code crash? It looks like I'm not doing anything bad. I'm calling malloc, that should be fine. And I'm calling printf without anything funny. So what sort of thing might be going on? And if you want to peek into this, we need to consider exactly where the signal might happen. So the thing about signals, like exceptions, is that they can happen anywhere. And we saw that when we were talking about implementing them in the operating system, we wanted to do things like disable interrupt before we change things signal handlers used. And the problem here is that we have a situation like that where it seems like we might want to have disabled things and didn't. So in particular, foo calls malloc, and because it calls malloc, we might have control C run in the middle of foo, in the middle of malloc called by foo. And printf It's a pretty complicated function in general. It might call malloc. So we might be calling malloc from within itself. And there's no real reason to think that malloc is going to be written to do that. So for example, one simplistic idea for implementing malloc is that you have a global variable of the next piece of memory to return, and you just increment that by the size and return the old value. Simple idea for implementing malloc, you know, and when we run out of space, we might allocate more when it goes too high or something like that. There's logic I'm not showing. This is overly simplified, but this is the sort of thing malloc might do. There's some global data structure it's accessing that tracks allocated memory that it can give back to the program. And if the signal happens right there, we're going to have some problems later on when we try to use what it returns, because it turns out that it might be something that is being used elsewhere. Because printf maybe calls malloc. And so you get this timeline where foo calls malloc, malloc set figures out what it's returning, then control C happens. We just timed it exactly right, which will happen like one in a million times, and then your user will be really disappointed. Then we call printf. Then printf calls malloc. Malloc sets its return value to the same thing because we haven't updated the global yet. So now printf's malloc returns the same value that foo's malloc returns. And now foo is changing a pointer that printf just freed or is using. One of the two. In either case, we're in trouble and we're going to have some really confusing effects because, you know, printf has this buffer that's going to be used by future calls to printf and things like that. And we'll change your output and it will happen like, you know, thousands of lines later in the program. And this is a concern we're going to have. So this is, you know, unsafe signals. And because of issues like that, this writing code with signal handlers is very tricky. You need to worry about problems like this. So what could either we as program authors or library writers, people who wrote printf and malloc, or operating system or hardware writers do to make this not happen? What are some options? How could we prevent things like this from happening? Yeah.
Well, so for certain predefined functions like malloc and realloc, you could have it so it can't actually stop it while it's in the middle of it. So it stops at the beginning of it, or it goes through malloc and then stops.
Okay, so we could say functions like malloc, they're important, they access global data. Why don't we use what we mentioned earlier, blocking signals, to say, make sure that while malloc is doing its job, while it's manipulating that global data structure and deciding what to return, that we don't get a control C being handled. It doesn't get handled until after that. So that would be one option. So we can protect every single call to every call to malloc that way by adding that code to malloc. And that would be a thing we could do. And the reason why Linux doesn't do that is because blocking and unblocking signals generally requires a system call on Linux. That's how it's implemented. And adding two system calls to every malloc call would make real programs much, much slower. But it is a valid option and the simplest way to fix this problem. But Linux doesn't do it because it would be slow. So the Linux and general Unix solution to this problem is they tell you, write your signal handlers really carefully. So they give you a list of what they call async signal safe functions, which are functions where they guarantee they'll do the right thing. So either the function doesn't have any global data it manipulates that would be dangerous, or it does what you described of blocking the signal so we don't handle it while we're doing our job. And this is a It's about a small list, but it doesn't include many things you would expect it to include. So it includes write and exit, which correspond to system calls. And this is why, when I showed you my example signal program, I used write instead of printf or something like that, and underscore exit instead of exit. Because I was aware of these rules and very carefully following them, even though that call to write is way more awkward than using printf. But it doesn't include things you would like to use in almost any C function, like printf or malloc or even exit. And that's because they care about making the library implementers have an easy time implementing those functions. Okay, so questions on signals in general? So, given this, my general advice is whenever I write code that deals with signals, I always try to handle it without signal handlers, using some other API. Or if I use signal handlers, I handle it where I block the signal almost all the time. And just unblock it when I'm like reading from a file, reading from the network or something like that. Okay. So we talked about, three related ideas. So we have exceptions. So exceptions were our hardware mechanism, which gives us the ability to divide our processor between different programs transparently. And the key idea here is that this is a mechanism for the operating system to run, even though there's not code explicitly saying, please run the operating system here most of the time. So we had system calls, which was a case where there was an instruction which says, have the operating system help me, but you know the instruction just says do that. It doesn't say jump to this part of the operating system. That's all decided by this exception table. We had exceptions in response to external events. When I have a key press, the operating system gets to run to decide what to do about it, whether to run a new program, whether to read the input or not, and so on. When we have errors, like the program accesses memory it's not supposed to, the processor doesn't just catch fire, it tells the operating system, hey, I had an error in this program, the operating system decides what to do, it can crash the program, or maybe it can do something more clever, like pretend the thing worked but emulate it in some different way. And so these exceptions gave us the thread part, the CPU emulation part of the process virtual machine. And it looks like we have a CPU to ourselves with all these instructions that are just for us, including these special system call things, and maybe, and including, you know, being able to run all the time, and even though something else is running on the same physical hardware, gives us that illusion. And we also had address spaces, which was what we'll talk about next time and over the next couple weeks, where it gives us the illusion we have our own memory, even though we're sharing that with other programs. It gives us the illusion in a way where we can't interfere with other programs by accident. We talked about signals, which I mentioned mainly because it's a user space. It's an in your program version of something like exceptions. It's not the same as exceptions. Most notably, they run in user mode, and it's the operating system which decides everything about how they work, not the hardware. But they have many of the same problems as exceptions. That safety problem, that need to block things very carefully, is the same sort of thing operating system writers need to deal with when they write exception handlers. And one of the reasons why writing operating systems is notoriously difficult. So, any questions on these issues? Okay, so, as I said, next time we'll talk about address spaces, but for now I have one bonus topic that we will not test on since the other class didn't get it. We have like an extra 10 minutes, well, 5 minutes. That's set jump and long jump. So one thing that people might expect to see when they saw exceptions on the schedule was for me to talk about those things that you throw. And you notice that we never talked about this. That is a different thing, which happens to share the same name, yet another example of how terminology for exceptions is hard. So the closest thing in C to that is something called set jump and long jump. So set jump is a function which takes this E and V and saves the state and returns a value, and yeah, saves the state into that environment. And then it returns a value. Later on, you can use a call to long jump, and that returns back to the set jump call and returns a different value. So you can, this is the C closest thing you have to try catch if you want to implement it. And this is actually something you can pretty much figure out how to implement. So what setJump is essentially doing is it's copying all the registers to its argument, including the stack pointer, and including knowing what its return address is. And longJump is just copying all the registers back, changing the return value, and jumping back to the return address setJump had. So setJump copies all the registers to its argument, to that E and V thing, and then remembers the PC it returns back to. And longJump just takes advantage of that. Uses that information to jump back after restoring all the registers. So this is the closest analogy that C has to try-catch. And it's also a way you could implement try-catch. So you just save all the state, then restore it all back where the try was, but you set one thing different so you can jump to the catch block instead of the try block. Does anyone see any problems with this? Yeah. So we could modify the stack. So what about the stack could be modified? Yeah, and would that be good, bad? So why would that be bad? Okay. So we might have changed a variable. So actually usually in try catch, we want variables we change on the stack to actually change. So usually that's okay. But we don't actually know everything that's on the stack because of how we're implementing this. We don't know whether that's going to put us in a bad state or not. But you're right. I mean, it's something to be worried about. And we don't know whether, if the stack's changed, some of those changes we want. If we changed a variable, we want to go back to the catch block and see that change variable. Some of it might be a saved value that we overwrote and would restore later. So it turns out that this, the compiler's being clever doesn't quite really work for that reason. Another issue is just with variables in general. Our variable might have been stored in a register and not the stack, and now we'll be changing that variable in some unexpected way. So here, the set jump runs the first part of the if statement, then long jump goes back to the set jump, but returns a different value. But if x is in a register, we may have changed the value of x back to its old value, or we might not have. And that's really bad, right? Sometimes we change it, sometimes we don't, depending on what the compiler does. That's really confusing. And in fact, in C, this is undefined behavior, which makes it really, really hard to use setJump. Just like it's really hard to use signal handlers. There is a version which is defined behavior, which is there's this keyword volatile, which says keep this value in memory. And that makes it defined behavior. It keeps it on the stack, and the stack isn't changed by setJump. So questions on setJump, long jump. So this is the simplest way to implement try-catch. But it's actually pretty slow. So usually, we think that catch blocks are not executed very often. And we're actually doing a lot of work just to set up our catch block, even though if we don't use it. We're still copying all the registers on 64-bit x86. That's a lot of registers. And also the condition codes. So it's pretty slow. And this is not, in fact, how something like C++ on a modern system implements exceptions. And that is try-catch. I'm going to say try-catch, not exceptions, to be clear. So the way modern C++ does this is that they want that this try not to execute any code. They only want you to pay a cost if you're running this throw. That's the goal. Because it seems like pretty annoying if just having a try statement that never gets used makes your program a lot slower. And that used to be the case if you're using like set jump, long jump style try catch. But there's a better way where you don't do that. Now the tricky thing is you still need to get back to that catch statement. And you want to do it, and you need to like change the stack, you need to restore all these, you know, variables. We aren't marking any local variables as volatile or anything like that. We need them to have a good value. So how do you do that? Well, the answer is we're gonna have a big data structure the compiler produces, which tells us how to get back to that catch statement. And the basic idea is we're gonna have this lookup table, we're gonna have ranges of program counter values, and instructions on how do you return from that function and restore values from the stack and so on. So we'll see, okay, you're called throw, you're here, so the way I get to the function that called refile is by popping from the stack into R12 and then looking there and going to that place. And then I end up in the middle of main here. And I find out, okay, the thing I'm supposed to do if I have an exception here is go to this main catch piece of the code where my catch block was compiled to. So the compiler is responsible for making this table. And it needs to make this table so we have instructions on how to return from the function and where all the exception handlers are. But this style of thing is the way that exception handlers are implemented on, try catch is implemented in C++. And this is not actual code, but this is like instruction. So there's like a big interpreter in the C++ library that handles this. So this is, nice in that there's no overhead if you don't throw. It's not nice in that you have to produce this table, which takes up space, and you have to have this code which interprets the table, which is slower than long jump is. But the hope is that throwing is rare. So it's worth doing that. Okay, so that was my bonus topic on how try-catch works. The two ways that try-catch might work, which is not exceptions, because exceptions are these hardware things where an event happens, it's usually often external, but I mention it because you saw exceptions on the schedule, you might expect to learn how those things in Java and C++ work. And that's what I have, so next time we'll talk about virtual memory, and good luck on the homework in the lab.